something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speaking their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. What a field day for the heat. A thousand people in the street singing songs and carrying signs. Mostly say hooray for our side. It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Strikes deep into your life, it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you away. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. We better stop now. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going on. We better stop.
Thanks for listening to great speeches and interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining this broadcast, we're listening to Progress and Climate Change with Ronald Wright. He speaks of the urgency to deal with climate change and talks about civilization's exploitation of nature leading to collapse.
My guest is Ronald Wright. We're talking about the future of the planet, short history of progress in the past of the planet. And you go into in some detail about how the Industrial Revolution, the economies, the wonderful rich economies of Europe were built on the backs of the indigenous people here who were killed or died of disease, and their resources were taken and sent back to the mother country to produce the kind of economy we have today, essentially.
Well, yeah, essentially we had this time when Europeans were in the right place at the right moment, and there was a feedback that the discovery not only of the gold and silver, I mean, both Karl Marx and Adam Smith, you know, the founding sort of thinkers of both Marxism and capitalism, both pointed to the wealth of the Inca and Aztec civilizations as being the startup money for the Industrial Revolution. It took quite a while for it to change from being, you know, Spanish loot into steam engines, but that was when the process really took off, because there was the money to develop new technologies, largely stimulated by wars, of course, especially the Spanish Empire's efforts to control the world. And then at the same time, even more important than that, gold and silver, was the food crops. Suddenly, you know, you've got both cold weather crops like potatoes, temperate crops like corn, and then tropical crops like the sweet potato and manioc, which spread around the world and which, for various reasons, were much more productive than the crops of the old world. They gave about twice the yield for half the work. So suddenly a much larger population could be supported. And then you've got the population of the Americas dwindling, largely because of disease, but also, of course, because they're constantly being pushed to the wall by murderous invaders. And you've also got, with these new crops, you've got the European population expanding very fast, and you've also got the African population expanding very fast. And the Europeans figured out that they could capture the Africans, there were people in Africa willing to sell their own people as foreign exchange, and then take them to the New World and put them to work in these lands that had been emptied by the plagues that wiped out their original owners. So that sort of pump going across the Atlantic, that interchange of crops, money, and land and people, led to this 500 years of great expansion and prosperity for some people, mainly Europeans and people of European descent in North America. And I think that fostered an idea that we were all, everything was always going to get bigger and better, and that the world would always be a land of opportunity, and that there would always be, each generation would always be more prosperous than the one before. And, you know, that was true for centuries, that that was what was happening if you were a person of the right color in the right place. But, of course, it's no longer true. There are no more empty continents. There are no more undiscovered miracle crops. You know, in spite of what the GM Foods people will tell you, not one new staple crop has ever been developed. All of our crops were developed long ago in prehistoric times. We can tinker with them, but that's all we can do. There are no new staples.
And we've largely fished the oceans. Now you go into a fish market, and you see most of the fish there is what they call farm-raised.
Yes. And actually right here on the coast of British Columbia, there's a lot of that, and it's very controversial. People who live here won't eat that stuff. They're happy to sell it to other people elsewhere, but they won't touch it here. And you see signs on the bumpers here that say, wild salmon don't do drugs.
That's great. One of the things you point out, and the pessimistic pointing out pessimistic position is that people, the people in so-called advanced societies have this feeling that you mentioned that we could keep on going forever, and the people collectively need to change their way of thinking, and it's very, very difficult when they have no guidance, no leadership. You look around the world today, it has to be done at every level, and particularly being at the government level. And you look at the United States today, both parties, but particularly the Republican Party, are living in another century. Want to deregulate. They think deregulation is the key to saving the United States, when it's nonsense.
Oh, well, you know, that has been disproved by recent history. I mean, the sort of that Friedmanite monetarist idea that you just deregulate and everyone will get so rich and it'll all trickle down and we'll all be happy. You know, I don't know why he got the Nobel Prize, Milton Friedman, because none of that was a new idea. That was simply a return to the kind of economics that we had in Victorian times. And it led to a feeding frenzy, and it ultimately led to the First World War and the Great Depression, the boom-bust thing, and then the Second World War. And, you know, that the first half of the 20th century, we learned those very painful lessons that if you just let capitalism rip, you're going to have boom-bust cycles, massive depressions. That creates a lot of people out of work. That creates extremist politics. And you're going to get things like Bolsheviks, Nazis, anarchists, and so forth. And so, you know, the consensus after the Second World War, and the United States took the lead in this, was to share things around and have regulation to even out the boom-bust cycle in economics. And, you know, from the late 1940s through to the late 1970s, that's the way the world was run, and that was a time of unprecedented prosperity. But since then, we've reverted to this sort of Victorian idea of dog-eat-dog capitalism, or at least many people advocate this. And the results are unplanned expansion of cities, which makes it impossible to put in transportation systems, and enormously widening gap between rich and poor. I mean, just an obscene gap between wealthy and poor, where, you know, the average person in the top 1%, you know, relative to the people at the bottom of the society, that's a bigger gap than between the pharaoh of Egypt and, you know, the guys dragging the stones for the pyramids. And you know, the other thing is that doesn't work even for the rich, because it is a recipe for revolution and war. It always has been. So, you know, it may work for a short term, but none of this works in the long term.
Amen. My guest is Ronald Wright. If you have any calls, quick questions or comments for Ronald Wright, you can give us a call here at 895-2448. You've given us a lot of food for thought. Do you see any positive signs on the horizon that governments are going to be able to deal, that any governments besides talking are ready to deal with the issue in a serious way?
Well, oh yeah, I think so. I do see some positive signs. I mean, I think for one thing, the European Union. Now, I know it's in some financial trouble, but the European Union was a remarkable thing. I mean, that is a sign of people learning from history. You know, these Europeans who've been trying to murder each other on a large scale for a couple of thousand years finally said, we can't go on doing this anymore. And the structure of the European Union, which is not quite a federation, but it is more than just a trading bloc, does balance the interests of business, the environment, and labor or social issues to a greater degree than any other such body anywhere in the world. And they have got a very aggressive carbon-cutting program. They are committed to 20% reduction from the original 1992 baselines by 2020, and they're spending the kind of money on that the U.S. was spending on the war in Iraq. It's about $90 billion U.S. dollars a year. That's just serious money. And they have said that they will go to a 30% target if other major players will, such as the U.S., such as China would have to come into that now. But
you can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Business everywhere runs a country through your hair. Lay my life on the line to dare. All these posers everywhere. Business in your face. Profit making every place. Even rebel music's laced. Time to give those fakes a taste. Who made business of the earth? Determined its godly worth. Time to put it in a hearse before this place really burst. Business everywhere. Babies use the word before they learn to walk the stairs. Anybody here say World Trade Organization? Perpetuating, exploiting peoples, tribes, and nations. Let's see if we can see how far back bad business started. Long before the pharaohs and the day the sea was parted. When Moses led the slaves through the waves to be saved. But tell me, did things really change? Look around the world, the top down is getting awful strange. Bad business getting poor people in a tizziness. Makes them want to blow up Babylon so high it's dizziness. Business at the center of the WTO. World Trade, what? OWTC center? You know, a disaster. Business making pollution grow faster. Made a crook of the doctor and the pastor. Took the president and made of him a bastard. And sells to you the rip-off rapper on your ghetto blaster. Who wants money first and justice second? I'm wrecking this. Throw the merchants out of the church, they're begging for a king-sized downfall. Beggars in the street because of y'all. Let it be known that dirty business made the world trade fall. Not terrorism, but businessism itself. Like the media putting war flicks on your shelf. A lot of wealth in your daily news and TV too. Papers, capers, congressmen are just escapers. It's true. Yeah. Oh, while the refugees go do 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 do. Business everywhere runs the country through your hair. Lay my life on the line to dare. All these posers everywhere. Business in your face. Profit making every place. Even rebel music's laced. Time to give those fakes a taste. Who made business of the earth? Determined its godly worth. Time to put it in a hearse before this place really bursts. Maybe I can put this differently. The new world order's gonna get hurt just by being me. Cause I ain't seen nothing but hype, no controversy. And so it looks like this time it might have to be me. So, yeah, confidentially, it's my personal business how the rockstar gets fame. Exploiting poor folks to get rich, so tell me who's to blame. Shame on you, you poser, wake up, party's over. Kill the Land Rover, army buggy, sold the world over. Yeah, the world is soon to be over. The way this here deal's going down, that's why it's my personal business how the Bush and Cheney families been doing business with the Hussein Laden families. And getting fights when things don't go quite right, you see, and whip up wars when they need profits for the military. The chickens already came home to roost. The cat is out the bag with tea shopping on the truth. But even if the dirty businessmen get their wars, the truth been told and will be known and grown forevermore. So if anybody doubts, look how Nero's remembered. Every lie finally leads to time and God surrenders. Yeah, while the refugees go do 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 do. Business everywhere runs the country through your hair. Lay my life on the line to dare. All these posers everywhere. Business in your face. Profit making every place. Even rebel music's laced. Time to give those fakes a taste. Who made business of the earth? Determined its godly worth. Time to put it in a hearse before this whole wide world bursts.
So they're leading the way with that, and they also just recently, I think yesterday, passed a tax on financial financial, big financial transactions, a tiny tax. It's just 1.1%, but this has been proposed for many decades. It's often known as the Tobin tax, after the man who first suggested it. And the idea here is two things. One is, if you put a very small tax on all the money that sloshes around the world every day, mainly for purely speculative purposes, currency speculation and so on, if you put a very small tax on that, it actually slows the thing down a bit and makes people think twice, and therefore may help to prevent the kind of meltdown that we saw in 08. That's one argument. The other argument is that if the world could agree on a Tobin tax, and this is really the first time it's ever been done, but if we could expand that to include most of the developed world, we would have a way of raising money from the people who have so much money they can barely count it on an international basis. And so it wouldn't be tied to any one national government. And it could then be used to address the absolutely critical issues of poverty and environmental degradation that must be addressed on a worldwide basis, that no one country can manage on its own.
Well, we have a board lit up here. A couple of people want to call here, so let us open the phone. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you so much for having this author. I have so enjoyed. Thank you so much, Jeffrey, and thank you for being on our airwaves. I'd love to hear your analysis of the Idle No More movement and where you think it's at this point. Thanks so much.
Thanks for calling.
Well, that's an excellent question. Thank you. I think of it just as a Canadian thing because it started here, but I guess it has a world profile now. And there are really, it seems to me, to be two things driving Idle No More. One is to improve the conditions of what we call First Nations people in Canada, which would be Native Americans in the States, Indigenous people, who many of whom live in terrible conditions, and to, you know, fulfill treaties that have not been fulfilled and that kind of thing. So that's one part of it. But another part, and this is something that goes far beyond just Native issues, is that we have a very, very right-wing, pro-big oil government at the moment. Our government is to the right of your government, which is not usually the way it is in Canada, but it is at the moment. And this government has, in the last two budget bills, which were much more than budget bills, has actually torn up most of the environmental protection legislation in Canada, including things that go back into the 19th century, protecting waterways, fisheries, things like that. And so there's been an all-out assault on the environment by the federal government for the purposes of massive oil expansion, mainly the infamous Alberta tar sands and the pipelines they want to build associated with that. And the Indigenous people are on the front line here because they're saying, if you're going to start degrading the rivers and the waterways and so forth, that is a violation of our treaty. And the majority of Canadians are in favor of protecting the environment. The polls always show that. This government took power with only 39% of the vote because of the peculiar voting system that we have. And here is a cause that Native people and people who've come more recently to Canada can unite over, which is the protection of the environment and a certain amount of social justice for everybody, especially for the people from whom this entire country was virtually stolen over the past century or two.
Well, we have another call here. I think we have to have you back on here again. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, Jeff. I'm calling from inland and wanted to add something to the comments about recycling spent nuclear fuel rods, which is that's a complete fallacy about how that is stored safely or recycled. That's how they're recycled is into depleted uranium weapons. And that's been a kind of a stealth operation that results in vaporization of highly radioactive material when weapons are used, which goes into the atmosphere, is breathed by people, goes on to the soil, gets put into the groundwater for more or less forever. So that should be added to the discussion about the nuclear energy option. Thank you for the wonderful guest.
Oh, thanks for the call.
Your call is absolutely right. Of course, that is a huge problem, the weaponization of this stuff. And a lot of it was used in the Iraq War, and there is a pattern of weird birth defects and so on, and also effects on American troops from where these weapons were used. In that sense, I mean, I didn't say that the stuff was being recycled safely. What I said is that the waste problem from nuclear power plants is relatively localized. It is not like carbon dioxide that goes everywhere. But, of course, if you start putting it into cannon shells and firing it around the world, then you are spreading it everywhere. So, I'm glad you brought that up, caller.
Of course, we had the situation at Fukushima. which we don't know the extent of the worldwide damage that's caused. I know from what I've heard, people in Japan, there's so much cover up of the Fukushima situation that people don't know what the truth is.
Well, there's been enough of these things now. I mean, there's been Three Mile Island, there's been Chernobyl, there's been Fukushima, and probably a few other minor ones. But there's enough of these things that, you know, nobody can really claim that this technology is safe. It is a technology that's barely under control, probably a very unwise option. Also, I think the idea that if we expand nuclear power plants, we can buy some time to deal with weaning ourselves off oil. That's quite an attractive idea, but it takes at least 10 years to get these things up and running. We don't really have 10 years to mess about with an old technology that already is problematic. We need to go into new technology and also conservation. I mean, if you can cut energy use by 25% or 50%, effectively you're doing the equivalent of building thousands of power stations, and you're doing it in the best possible way, which is not having to build them.
Ronald, I have to. I see the clock is coming to the end of the hour. It's a good way to end it. We all need to do what we can do to save the planet. Ronald White, I want to thank you so much for being our guest today. Listeners, go to his website. It's Ronald Wright, WRIGHT, one word, ronaldwright.com. And you can see what books he's written. And I do want to have you back. Thank you very, very much for a very enlightening morning.
Well, thank you very much, Jeff.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Coming up next, from the movie Judgment at Nuremberg, Ernest Jenning confesses his guilt to the tribunal.
Herr Janning, you may proceed.
I wish to testify about the Feldenstein case because it was the most significant trial of the period. It is important not only for the tribunal to understand it, but for the whole German people. But in order to understand it, one must understand the period in which it happened. There was a fever over the land, a fever of disgrace, of indignity, of hunger. We had a democracy, yes, but it was torn by elements within. Above all, there was fear. Fear of today, fear of tomorrow, fear of our neighbors, and fear of ourselves. Only when you understand that can you understand what Hitler meant to us. Because he said to us, lift your heads, be proud to be German. There are devils among us, communists, liberals, Jews, gypsies. Once these devils will be destroyed, your misery will be destroyed. It was the old, old story of the sacrificial lamb. What about those of us who knew better? We who knew the words were lies and worse than lies? Why did we sit silent? Why did we take part? Because we loved our country. What difference does it make if a few political extremists lose their rights? What difference does it make if a few racial minorities lose their rights? It is only a passing phase. It is only a stage we are going through. It will be discarded sooner or later. Hitler himself will be discarded sooner or later. The country is in danger. We will march out of the shadows. We will go forward. Forward is the great password. And history tells how well we succeeded, Your Honor. We succeeded beyond our wildest dreams. The very elements of hate and power about Hitler that mesmerized Germany, mesmerized the world. We found ourselves with sudden powerful allies. Things that had been denied to us as a democracy were open to us now. The world said, go ahead, take it. Take it! Take Sudetenland! Take the Rhineland! Remilitarize it! Take all of Austria! Take it! And then one day, we looked around and found that we were in an even more terrible danger. The ritual began in this courtroom, swept over the land like a raging, roaring disease. What was going to be a passing phase had become the way of life. Your Honor, I was content to sit silent during this trial. I was content to tend my roses. I was even content to let counsel try to save my name, until I realized that in order to save it, you would have to raise the specter again. You have seen him do it. He has done it here in this courtroom. He has suggested that the Third Reich worked for the benefit of people. He has suggested that we sterilized men for the welfare of the country. He has suggested that perhaps the old Jew did sleep with the 16-year-old girl after all. Once more, it is being done for love of country. It is not easy to tell the truth, but if there is to be any salvation for Germany, we who know our guilt must admit it, whatever the pain and humiliation. I had reached my verdict on the Feldenstein case before I ever came into the courtroom. I would have found him guilty, whatever the evidence. It was not a trial at all. It was a sacrificial ritual in which Feldenstein, the Jew, was the helpless victim.
Your Honor, I must interrupt. The defendant is not aware of what he's saying. He's not aware of the implications.
I am aware. My counsel would have you believe we were not aware of the concentration camps. Not aware. Where were we? Where were we when Hitler began shrieking his hate in the Reichstag? Where were we when our neighbors were being dragged out in the middle of the night to Dachau? Where were we when every village in Germany has a railroad terminal where cattle cars were filled with children being carried off to their extermination? Where were we when they cried out in the night to us? Are we deaf, dumb, blind?
Your Honor, I must protest.
My counsel says we were not aware of the extermination of the millions. He would give you the excuse. We were only aware of the extermination of the hundreds. Does that make us any the less guilty? Maybe we didn't know the details. But if we didn't know, it was because we didn't want to know.
Traitor! Traitor!
Order! 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 Put that man back in his seat and keep him there.
I am going to tell them the truth. I am going to tell them the truth if the whole world conspires against it. I am going to tell them the truth about their ministry of justice. Werner Lampe, an old man who cries into his Bible now, an old man who profited by the property expropriation of every man he sent to a concentration camp. Friedrich Hofstetter, the good German, who knew how to take orders, who sent men before him to be sterilized like so many digits. Emil Hahn, the decayed, corrupt bigot, obsessed by the evil within himself. And Ernst Janning, worse than any of them, because he knew what they were. And he went along with them, Ernst Janning, who made his life excrement because he walked with them.
More from Great Speeches and Interviews after these messages.